Cedar. Introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives. That's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, February 2nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. As we speak, Mubarak paid operatives, I guess. I mean, maybe that's too sophisticated of a word for these people. They seem to be basically thugs. Have entered into Liberation Square, Tahrir Square in Cairo over the past 3 or 4 hours. And the situation has turned incredibly violent and ugly. You had hundreds of thousands of pro-democracy, or I guess really more accurately would be anti-Mubarak protesters peacefully in Tahrir Square, surrounded by military who have essentially are functioning almost as, it seems, UN peacekeepers would. They do not seem to be engaging one way or another. And into Tahrir Square about two and a half hours ago, came streaming in via government buses, plainclothes members of the internal security forces of Egypt, and maybe just those who are being paid, and began to strike up violence. There are fires. There's an attempt to light the National Museum on fire. There have been rocks. There have been horses and camels people are riding in on, and essentially trying to create a rash of violence to, I guess, presumably, to either intimidate the people in Tahrir Square. They cannot seem, from all the reports that I've been listening to and reading on Twitter, the internet is back up, incidentally, in Egypt. There seems to be no way for them to even get out of the square at this point. And there's tremendous amount of violence. TV cameras are there, and so they've been recording this. The military seems to essentially be completely befuddled as to what to do. According to Ben Wiederman in from CNN, he tweeted just about a half an hour ago that he overheard some soldiers talking about they didn't know what to do. And there have been apparently attempts to bring armored vehicles in there, but the pro-Mubarak paid pro-Mubarak constituency has been riding on the back of these military vehicles in an attempt to get closer to the anti-Mubarak protesters. And so the military personnel actually just drive back because they don't want these two parties to mix. I'm looking at tweets right now. And in Egypt, Tahrir Square is now anti-Mubarak protesters' Alamo. I'll read you just some of the tweets in just a moment, but let's play some audio. Yesterday, Mubarak came out with a speech, and apparently there's some strange music underneath it that's part of the Al Jazeera English feed, but he expresses his intention. Well, let's listen to this Mubarak audio from yesterday.
I did not intend to run for the coming presidency. I have exhausted my life serving Egypt and its people. However, I am totally keen on ending my career for the sake of the nation in a way that guarantees handing over the banner in an atmosphere of security, stability, safeguarding our legitimacy and preserving the Constitution. I tell you in plain words that in the few months remaining in my current term, I will work towards ensuring the measures and procedures that will guarantee the peaceful transition of power by virtue of the powers and authorities vested in me by the Constitution.
And so there's Mubarak basically saying, I'm going to hang on until new elections in September. Trust me, I'm going to go retire after that. And, of course, the anti-Mubarak protesters are both, I think, skeptical of his claim and also concerned about who would follow him. More than likely at this point, Suleiman, as we had that conversation with Heather Hurlburt yesterday from the National Security Network. If you haven't listened to yesterday's program, I want to really implore you to listen to Heather Hurlburt. That was great information there, and fascinating to listen to the Juan Cole interview we did about a week ago, and his projections that this what had happened in Tunisia was not going to happen in Egypt, and this caught I think most people by surprise. Although Heather Hurlburt seemed to indicate that the Egyptian military who were visiting the Pentagon might have had some concern. And so this is ongoing. Ben Wiedemann from CNN says that the intervention by these thugs in Tahrir Square seems to be government sanctioned. White House issues pale, weak statement on situation in Cairo. Imagine if Tahrir were Tehran. This is from Ben Wiedemann and CNN. I mean, he's being fairly aggressive for CNN, frankly. And I'm going to read some tweets just to give you a sense from my Egypt list. I haven't quite prepared this, but Traveler W, let's make a deal. When there are people getting killed, it's immoral to be worried about the museum. Like I said, the museum is on fire. It seems that the military is attempting to halt the fire in the museum. But they are not protecting the civilians. Travel W, Muhammad, that's all it says. 16 minutes ago, Mubarak thugs are setting the museum garden on fire to keep the army busy while their buddies massacre civilians. They're comparing it to Tiananmen Square in 1989. Man in megaphone is shouting names to reunite families that were separated in the mayhem. Belidi, he was trying to protect a little girl. Captured people are with weapons, knives. Some are police. Someone is asking, Sarah Naguib, if we go offline again, please direct all media to Tahrir Square. Ben's Wiedemann from CNN, 7 minutes ago, just got out of Tahrir. Very ugly. Something is being cooked up there. Tiananmen 2, is this stability? The army has left Ard El Gulf, it seems. Someone just called us out to the people on the mosque mic saying the roads are completely empty. So people are very concerned with what's going on there. And 38 minutes ago, Sand Monkey in Tahrir Square, pro-Mubarak people are throwing Molotov cocktails on the Egyptian Museum and setting it on fire. And so it is becoming incredibly ugly there as we speak. Here is Mona Elfway. She's the Egyptian journalist. She is on Al Jazeera. Reacting to Mubarak's speech yesterday and calling for the Obama administration to do more. This is her reaction to the speech yesterday. This, of course, is prior to the violence that is taking place today.
When Hosni Mubarak addressed Egypt today, he added further insult to injury by talking as if, you know, it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago when he could say, I will step down and people could accept it. Again, he's completely out of touch. And he talks like this father who is going to protect his people from chaos when he is the reason this chaos is in place in the first place. So unless the Obama administration understands this ever-widening gap between Mubarak and Egypt and understands that we're talking now about Mubarak on one side and Egypt on the other, and that it must side with Egypt, this one man must not bring his country down, then the Obama administration is both deaf and blind.
There you have it. And, you know, I don't know at this point. The reports that I was hearing earlier this morning were basically to the effect that, you know, the United States really at this point has no real leverage with the Egyptian, with Mubarak. We're talking about $1.4 billion of military assistance to Egypt. The number's probably higher, but we're talking about an economy that has a GDP of somewhere around $200 billion. And so at this point, the threat to the Mubarak regime is existential. And I'm sure that short of a threat from the U.S. to militarily intervene, which I think we all know is unlikely and impossible, and frankly, in my estimation, inappropriate, there doesn't seem to be much that the United States can do in terms of actually leveraging anything with Mubarak. Perhaps there is some leverage with the Egyptian military, and it's unclear right now what kind of signals the Egyptian military is getting from the U.S. military. I would imagine it will always be unclear. And so this is ongoing. And, you know, I know a lot of people are going to be, you know, listen to this podcast a day, sometimes 2 days later, and things on the ground will have changed. But, hopefully this will give you some sense of what was happening at this moment. Later in this program, we will be talking to Chris Hayes, who has been in Davos. And, of course, Thomas Friedman has been doing a yeoman's job in Davos, wearing his leather jacket in solidarity with the Egyptian protesters. Has anybody heard any dispatches from Thomas Friedman? I'm sure that he must have talked to a cab driver somewhere or a rickshaw driver or perhaps the person who carried his luggage into the gorgeous hotel that I'm sure he's staying at. You know, his wife's a billionaire. And I'd be very curious as to what his sense is of what's happening here. Did he say something like the Egyptian people should suck on this? Of course, I'm referring to his famous quote as to why we needed to go into Iraq so that American boys and girls could bust down the doors from, I think it was from, I can't remember, from Baghdad to Basra, and hold a gun in the face of the Iraqis and say, suck on this. What part of this don't you understand? Anything? Did you hear anything, Dorsey, from Friedman?
No.
Well, that's good. Also, later in this program, coming up in just a moment, Ben CNN, people in Tahrir Square are begging Obama to intervene. You know, short of moral support, I don't know what the U.S. government could do. I am not being an apologist here for the position the U.S. government has, but 500 and more injured in Tahrir Square. This is coming from AFP, out of somebody who's tweeting from Beirut. Also coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll be talking to Mike Stark. I've mentioned this in the past. There is a brewing scandal, apparently, with John Boehner that is going to, I'll let Mike Stark tell the story. But it should be interesting. And I think in the past I've articulated my sense that there are teabaggers in the Republican caucus who have been gunning for John Boehner, not the least of which because he seems to be incapable of carrying on a conversation without crying. Could be out of sheer annoyance, but I suspect it's a notion that Boehner is able to is not as much with the teabagging program as they would like. One quick story before we go to Mike Stark. You'll recall that several weeks ago we interviewed Josh Fox on his movie Gasland, which has since been nominated for an Oscar. And I can assure you his interview had nothing to do with that. My influence with the Academy has dwindled significantly.
It's not what it used to be.
It's not what it used to be. When you get yourself fired from According to Jim, you are virtually blacklisted from the Hollywood community. So the AP reports that oil and gas companies have injected more than 32 million gallons of diesel fuel underground without first getting government approval. This is a report by congressional Democrats released on Monday. Lawmakers said the use of diesel fuel by large companies such as Halliburton and BJ Services Company appears to violate the Safe Drinking Water Act. And notice the language here. Appears to violate the Safe Drinking Water Act. What we learned from Josh Fox, and I subsequently learned on an interview I did for Ring of Fire, which plays on Saturdays, incidentally, folks. And this week I'll be talking to Juan Cole, discussing the situation in Egypt, and a couple other folks from the healthcare convention that I went to over the weekend. If you're not listening to Ring of Fire, you're missing a lot of great interviews and a lot of great conversation with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. And that's on the weekends. And you can go to ringoffireradio.com to check that out. But I also spoke to the head of the Catskill Mountain Keepers about fracking because it's a big issue. Same area that Josh Fox had basically learned of the issue upstate New York. And we recall from that Josh Fox interview that because of the so-called Halliburton loophole in the Clean Water Act, these fracking companies do not have to reveal what they use in their fracking fluids. And in fact, nothing they use is explicitly illegal. So notice the sort of qualified notions in this piece appears to violate the Safe Drinking Water Act. The year-long probe was led by Henry Waxman, Edward Markey, Diana DeJet, and House Energy Commerce Committee. The industry, quote, has been saying they stopped injecting toxic diesel fuel into wells. But our investigation showed this practice has been continuing in secret in an apparent violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act, said Mr. Waxman. The investigation found that 12 of 14 companies hired to perform hydraulic fracturing used diesel alone or in a mixture from 2005 to 2009. Now, this is an ongoing investigation for the past year, so I would imagine this is still ongoing practice. It's just that data was only taken from those years. Of the 32.2 million gallons reported, most was injected in Texas, followed by Oklahoma, North Dakota, Louisiana, and Wyoming. And the study found that a small amount, relatively speaking, was used in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection spokesman John Repet said that the state's not aware of any use of the diesel fuel and frack fluid here, based upon the company's disclosures of the chemicals they use on each well site. But now they're not legally bound to disclose all the chemicals they're using. So that would be that. The three lawmakers are looking to find more information on benzazine, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. I don't know what those are, but they don't sound like you'd want to drink them. Quote, Halliburton, this is from a Halliburton spokesperson, Teresa Wong, does not believe that the company's hydraulic fracturing activities have resulted, listen carefully, in a violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act or any other federal environmental law. There are currently no requirements in the federal environmental regulations that require a company to obtain a federal permit prior to undertaking a hydraulic fracturing project using diesel. In other words, there's no federal requirement that they disclose or get any permit for anything they're using because of the so-called Halliburton loophole. And so, of course, they're not in violation in their minds for using diesel fuel because they can do what they want. Industry representatives said the 2005 federal law merely allowed the EPA to have oversight. But there's no regulations allowed by the law. That is the Halliburton loophole. We've got to take a break. When we come back, hopefully we'll be talking to Mike Stark, and he will update us on this whole Bonaire thing. Be right back. Welcome back to Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone is the great Mike Stark, formerly of Calling All Wingnuts. He would, and he still does probably, but just as a hobby, call into right-wing talk shows and point out how ridiculous they are. And over the years, Mike Stark has been fearless in trying to bring his video camera and expose the right-wing hypocrisy of people like Bill O'Reilly or Senator George Allen. And his latest first story broke before the election. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Thanks, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, listen, what we're going to do is just give me a little backdrop. We're going to play the audio from your videos that you made back in, and you didn't make them. You actually just simply brought your camera out there and did some reporting back in late October, I believe it was. Just set the stage.
Late September. It was late September. It was the day they rolled out their silly little Pledge to America thing. I figured that'd be a good time to ask Boehner if I could get in touch with him, how that pledge to his wife was holding up.
Okay, and so... So you went up to Boehner. Now, what made you? Well, let's play the audio. You won't be able to hear it, but we're going to play it right now. Here it comes.
Okay.
Speaker Boehner, have you been cheating with Elizabeth Lyons, the lobbyist for the American Printing Association?
Watch your back, sir.
Have you been sleeping with Elizabeth Lyons? Thank you.
You asked him if he'd been sleeping with Elizabeth Lyons. What was his response? Nothing.
Zero. Just, I mean, it's not too bad people can't see the video because I could have licked the tan off the man if I wanted to. I was that close to him. And he ignored me. I asked him twice and he just kept walking. I had to step out of his way. Otherwise, he would have walked right through me. No response at all. So I went home.
Now, let me ask you this. Why did you ask him that question? I mean, who was this woman? I mean, I don't want you to reveal a source if you can't do that. But I mean, tell me, where did you get this information, or how did it come to you, or did you just make up a name, or what?
No, you know, I've been doing that Stark Reports thing up on the Hill, so I hear different things, and this isn't any big secret here in D.C. It was gossip, you know, but then. Somebody that I've used in the past as a source, who I consider to be reliable, never been burnt by him, not a single time, gave me the name and background on her and a little bit more information. So with that, I decided it was worth at least asking.
Okay. Now, let me just ask you this one question. And again, if you don't feel comfortable telling me this, Is there party affiliation Republican or Democrat?
Yeah, I'm not even going to say that.
Okay, fair enough.
The one thing that I have said so far is that it didn't come from Mike Pence or any of his people. Some of that information had been speculated, I do have a decent relationship with Mike Pence. He knows me when he sees me, and we'll chat here and there. But I didn't think it was fair for him, for people to say that he was my source when he definitely wasn't.
Okay.
So that's the only thing I've said about my source on this.
All right. So you went home after that confrontation with Bonaire, and then you called the woman in question, and here's the audio from that. You won't be able to hear it, but here it is.
Hi, Elizabeth. My name's Mike Stark. How are you? Listen, I was just with House Minority Leader Boehner, and I asked him about an affair he may be having with you. Before I go to press, I just wanted to give you the opportunity to comment.
Sorry, what publication are you in?
I'm with Stark Reports, Huffington Post, Daily Kos.
Okay, I actually have no comment on that.
No comment at all. Thank you, Ms. Lyons. Bye.
So you got a no comment at all on that, and I don't know. I'm not going to judge. If I was not having an affair, which is not to imply that I am having an affair, but if I was not having an affair, and someone called me and said, "Are you having an affair with
Michelle Bachmann?"
Michelle Bachmann. I think I would probably say no, but I don't know. Maybe I would just say no comment.
Are you nuts? I don't know if we can swear on your radio. So
I mean, actually,
that'd be my reaction.
I would actually say if someone did call me and ask me that, I probably would say no comment, just because I would want to keep the story alive at that point.
Sure.
But be that as it may, the reason why we're talking to you today is why?
Well, National Enquirer is out with their story. It'll hit the newsstands tomorrow. But this thing kind of lied dormant. Right after I posted the video, there was a news item call it news if you want to, on page 6 of the New York Post, saying that the New York Times and other liberals were out to smear Boehner in the run-up to the election, and that they'd be highlighting this affair story. And I think they linked my site. So there was a little bubble of attention, but nothing really came of it. Then last week I got a call from a National Enquirer reporter asking a lot of the same questions you've already asked me. And I provided him with some information regarding interests in his district that he was being lobbied on by this lobbyist that he didn't stick up for. His district lost a few hundred jobs at a paper mill. And she lobbies for the printing industry, who love the cheap paper they're getting from China. So, you know, upwards of 20 or 30 congressmen, bipartisan, that represent districts doing a lot of paper production, had sent a letter to the president. They had all signed it, and Boehner was one of the only ones that refused to sign it. Well, you know, you can't – what was he going to do, sign it on her back? You know, I think there's a quid pro quo there. I mean, I'm speculating here, but it could even be a criminal thing if politicians were capable of being criminals in this country, that is.
Right. I understand. Now, let me just ask you this. So you got called by the National Reporter. The story's coming out that you've already seen. The screen grab of the cover. Now we know the National Enquirer has actually been quite reliable in these areas in the past. But let me ask you this: some time ago, I saw a piece by Matt Lewis, a Republican operative, who wrote about John Boehner's drinking problem. And I thought that's very strange for a Republican to be writing something like that, particularly a guy who's sort of a partisan Republican. Do you think, just based on your general sense of being on the Hill, that there is an effort by members of his own caucus to get rid of John Boehner?
You know, I can't speculate on the intrigue. The one thing I will say is that, you know, it's entirely possible, but why would they let him become speaker in the first place? Why wouldn't somebody get a message to him saying, you know, you take this job and bad things are going to happen. This is what we know. Why would they? Why would the Republican Party want to give themselves a black eye when they could have done it so much more quietly just a couple of weeks ago?
I guess that's a good point. That's interesting. Although we know how Trent Lott was taken out, and I still contend that if you look back on the first reporting of Trent Lott's comments that ultimately brought him down, it was reported upon by conservatives, and we all know that George Bush wanted Bill Frist in there. So who knows what it takes to get people out of power? We're seeing this whether it's in Capitol Hill or in Egypt.
Yeah, at the same time, I mean, Republicans have never been known for their competence or forethought in anything at all, except winning elections.
All right, be that as it may, I don't know if that's sarcastic or not, but I think they're pretty good at some of this stuff. But who knows? But Mike Stark, congratulations on breaking this story that now seems to be getting substantial play. You have the first video and the first audio of the players in this denying it or ignoring the question. And so people can go to starkreports.com. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm going to put a link up to the screen grab of the National Enquirer story so people can get a early look at it. Looks like somebody grabbed one from the newsstand delivery and took a picture of the full article. I'm looking at it right now. The image isn't good enough to read, but it says he cheated with at least two women. One was a secretary in some Republican's office as well. But that was back in 97. The Lions thing is more current.
All right. Well, Mike Stark, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks, man. Bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Chris Hayes, fresh off his trip from Davos. And I can't wait to hear about the different food that he got to eat, and I wonder if he caught a show there. We'll be right back after this. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, fresh off his worldwide, his jet-setting ways in Davos. Chris Hayes, welcome to the program, Chris.
Well, thank you. I think actually after you go to Davos, you're officially a knight. So if you want to just call me Sir Chris Hayes, that would be appreciated.
Yes, of course, Sir Knight, Sir Chris Hayes. Welcome. Am I picking up a slight British accent now from you? Have you picked up a type of continental accent?
Just the faintest hint of one, I hope. You don't want to lay it on too thick.
No, of course. You need to keep people wondering. Is he from South Africa? Is this Swiss? I just mentioned to you before we got on that we were inspired by the wonderful dispatches from Thomas Friedman from Davos, wearing one of the most fascinating leather coats I've ever seen, which apparently is what you've got to wear in Davos so that you don't look too like you're not, you know, you don't look too much like a billionaire. You got to look like you're a little
right.
bit street.
Yeah. That's right.
We've photoshopped one for you that you can send out if you end up putting out any dispatches, or maybe for a back cover of your next book.
Well, if you'll give me, if it's under a Creative Commons license, I may very well do that.
Of course it is. So, all right. So tell us, just give us some background. What is Davos?
So Davos has actually been going on for 40 years. It's the kind of title signature conference convened by an organization called the World Economic Forum, which was started by a Swiss economist named Klaus Schwab in 1971. This is, I guess, the 40th anniversary, I think, or maybe 72. And it has grown, as far back as the late 1980s, Samuel Huntington had coined the phrase Davos man to describe the sort of basically members of the global ruling class, I think, is probably the best way of describing them. The sort of superstars of the commanding heights of the neoliberal globalized order, who all convene in this Swiss alpine skiing resort town for 4 days for a conference that's ostensibly about ideas and global leadership, but is essentially just about getting a lot of powerful people in the same place where they can, look at each other's iPads and swap business cards and have meetings.
And so now, I mean, I remember talking to Naomi Klein about when she was at Davos, I guess it was maybe 6 years ago now, and there were protests at the time, and she was sort of going from the protest to inside the conference, I guess. Were there protests this time, or did it?
I think, there were some protests, although they were mostly on the last day, or the last night, I guess, when I was leaving. I had heard on my way out that there was protests, but nothing really. I mean, certainly nothing on the order of, what happened in 1999 in Seattle. I mean, certainly nothing that basically completely not visible. And I think part of that is the work of the Swiss police who, cordoned them off far from the convention center, et cetera. But it wasn't like... It did not factor into the experience of those who are inside. In fact, the first few days I looked around and was sort of looking for protesters, and I saw there was one scheduled for the Saturday, but the first few days it seemed pretty clear of protests.
Now, who protests at these things? Are they mostly millionaires protesting the billionaires?
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because, I mean, part of what's so weird about Davos is that, and I talked to Felix Salmon, who's the great financial blogger at Reuters, who's also got a similarly kind of jaundiced view of the whole enterprise, about the phenomenon of fractal inequality. So fractal inequality is inequality that, whenever you zoom into one layer of it, it sort of reinscribes itself. So, the gap between the top 5% and top 1% is the same as the gap between the top 1% and the top 0.02%, right? And on and on and on. And you see that at Davos, part of the thing I found alienating and bizarre and kind of radicalizing about Davos is that you realize that Davos is like a set of nested Russian dolls. And unless you're Jimmy Dimon or whoever, you're really only getting to the outer set. You know what I mean? Even the way the credentials worked, I had a press pass, but the press pass didn't even let you up to the second floor where the sort of actual conference was taking place. So you're always aware there's this kind of bizarre, infinite regress of access and hierarchy in which you're always aware that, and I think this sort of feeling stalks even, people that are actually powerful and important, unlike myself, that, they're not going to the right meetings and the right dinners, and there's... So it's the whole thing is kind of gross. I mean, it's not surprising that it's gross, but it was gross in a kind of visceral, spiritually deadening way that I maybe didn't anticipate.
Well, that sounds like fun. Did you get into a hot tub?
Yeah, I mean, it was so funny because I came back and it's like, whatever, you're like, I'm in Davos, and everyone's like, wow, look at you, and I'm like, it was awful. By the last day, I was like, Jesus Christ. I was honestly, and I never feel this way in my life at home because I love what I do, and as the days fly by, so I haven't had the experience. I was saying to my wife when I got home that I had not had this experience since crappy summer jobs in high school of watching the clock and counting down the hours until I could get on a plane to get the hell out of that place.
So what type of things happen, let's say, on the first floor? What type of things happen on the second floor? Are there conferences? One story I had heard about Davos was, I think that was back when there was a grandstanding by, gosh, I can't remember the actress's name, Sharon Stone, about netting there, about bringing
right.
mosquito nets in some
yes.
session. And Naomi Klein had told me that, you know, she was the participants there who were looking, NGOs who were looking to get money from these billionaires, were a little bit upset because in some way Sharon Stone had let these billionaires off with donations of, you know, $40,000 to buy mosquito nets when people were actually looking for hundreds of millions of dollars to create infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the things, it's not, you know, I think the Clinton Global Initiative, which has its own problems, you know, one of the things I think that makes it different and sort of, because it's CGI is a somewhat similar kind of thing. It's A, more development-oriented, and B, you know, Clinton has this big thing of everyone leaving with commitments. In Davos, it's just all talk. And the thing that I think was sort of frustrating is that, like, it turns out you don't need to fly to the Swiss Alps to, like, hear the same skull-rattling cliches that the global ruling class likes to deploy in order to defend the neoliberal order. Like, it's not, you know, you can go read Tom Friedman columns or the Wall Street Journal op-ed page. You know, it all sounds the same in person, more or less. I mean, you know, blah, 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 free, you know, labor mobility, free trade. We have to deal with sovereign debt problems, rising China and India, the West. Social welfare states are untenable and have to be quote unquote reformed, which means dismantled. And what's so striking to me actually is, you know, one of the weirdest thing about it, right, is that I described it to someone as it was a little like attending a family reunion 2 years after the family patriarch has been busted for incest, right? because it's like, on the one hand, it's like the family's still the family and we're still going to get together and, like, spend this time together as a family. At the other hand, this horrible thing happened that basically would prompt any rational person to question the core of everything. And yet it's so obvious that it's almost taboo. Like, we can't really even talk about it. So it's like the global financial crisis that was precipitated in no small measure by the sort of institutional apparatus that was put in place through the people that attend Davos, that financial crisis is like has to be kind of held in parallel with the sort of persistent fidelity to the vision. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. So there was no moments, there's no Alan Greenspan moments of, I realize that everything I believe for the past 40 years has been absolutely wrong.
Well, here's what's funny. They're just these little, like, brush fires. I mean, that's what I mean about this weird kind of, like, taboo sensation, because it's like, obviously, any thinking person, even someone who believes, and there are people, you know, I don't want to be too cynical. I mean, there are people who genuinely sort of believe, I think, in good faith in the sort of ability of this kind of neoliberal global order to really confer maximum human benefits for the population there. And you know, I don't want to sort of distinguish who believes that in good faith and who believes it out of because it puts billions of dollars in their pocket. But even if you really believe in it, I mean, you got to wrestle with what happened, right?
Right.
And wrestling with what happens, like, you know, calls into question all this stuff. So what you do see is there's these little moments, like Jim Balsillis, who's the CEO of Research in Motion, which makes BlackBerry. You know, it was this hilarious thing. It's a panel on sustainable development, which is moderated by the one and only mustache of understanding, Tom Friedman, not in a bomber jacket, but in a very Saturday casual sweater and kind of like Merrill hiking sneakers. And I will say, to Friedman's credit, it was a pretty interesting panel. Friedman, the moment when Friedman is sort of most likable is when he's talking about, you know, the need to do something on global climate change. Even though his solution to that is sort of like, like shamefully anti-democratic, but that's a whole other story. But so Jim Balsillis gets up there and he basically says, in this amazing moment of like profound honesty, says, look, we can all sit up here and pat ourselves on the back about the virtuous green initiatives we're doing, and some businesses are doing really good stuff. He's like, but the problem gets worse every single year. We're in a deep hole, and basically what it requires is a radical rethinking of the entire, like, field of economics. It has to be a radical rethinking on the order of Adam Smith, on the order of Keynes, on the order of the moment in the world when we decided slavery was no longer acceptable, right? Like, this is, like, a really,
right,
like, profound, righteous point this guy's making. And then he, like, finishes, and, like, the next guy to go up is a Walmart executive who's like, I'd like to talk about our wonderful green initiatives.
Right. So there's just this, like, notion of, like, who farted? Somebody farted on the panel, and everybody just pretended like they didn't smell it, essentially.
Exactly. So it's not that there aren't people there. And Balsillis, in his, you know, to his great credit, announced at Davos that he was giving $25 million to the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which is the kind of think tank being that was set up by George Soros, being run by the amazing Rob Johnson, to kind of create, you know, basically a funding, a consistent revenue stream to fund heterodox economics, alternative economic vision. So Balsillis really put his money where his mouth is, you know, to his great credit. And so you have this weird awkwardness. You have this very strange kind of parallel. So 80% of what you see there is no different than what you would have seen in 1998.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like the vision, in the same way, and it's occurred to me while I was there, in the same way that 80% of the domestic portion of Barack Obama's speech could have been Clinton's speech in 1998.
Right. People don't seem to realize that there's been that we need a paradigm shift based upon the situation we're in.
And what's remarkable is to compare that to what happened in the 1970s, because basically what happened in the 1970s was that you had a genuinely, you know, crappy economy. You had high unemployment and very high inflation. You had this famous stagflation. You had the same sense of declinism and ennui. And what happened was that sort of the Milton Friedman School came along and Ronald Reagan came along, and they basically said, this isn't just a set of supply shocks from oil embargoes in the Middle East. This is the ultimate stake through the heart of the Keynesian New Deal order. This demonstrably shows that the old order does not work, this crisis. And, you know, and so we launched on this sort of 30-year sort of post-Reagan Chicago school neoliberal agenda. And it's amazing to contrast that to now, where the crisis is actually much bigger than what was faced in the 70s. In terms of the real effects on average people, right? I mean, in the 70s, the effects were felt very hard at the top. Corporate profits were at an all-time low in 1973. In this crisis, the effects are much more distributed towards the bottom.
Right.
Particularly the bottom in the developed world. You know, that's in some ways where it's sort of, where the decline has been most intense. And there has been no similar sort of collective consensus that the crisis fundamentally invalidated the order that produced it.
And that's essentially a function of the lack of leverage that those sectors have, essentially, in on the world stage and in our own national stage.
Yeah, and I think it's a function of the distribution of power, both in the U.S. and then in the developed world and then the entire global order, in which you know, a very small amount of people have a lot of just outsized amounts of money and influence. And the, you know, the other thing is that, you know, the other weird thing, the other sort of dichotomy, is the fact that, like, you know, China grew at 8%, India grew at 8%. So, you know, the Eastern economies, I mean, China growing at 8% is a little bit suspect, because no one can never be sure. You know, the Chinese central government announces an estimate for annual GDP growth at the beginning of every year, and, like, lo and behold, by the end of the year, they always hit it right on the mark.
They're so really good at predicting things.
Yeah. So it's a little suspect about whether how real that growth is. But you know, if you go to China, it definitely feels like a place that is growing. And so, you know, that's the other part of it, is that, you know, there is a sort of feeling like, there's this general feeling that sort of suffused Davos, which is like, man, the West is done. Like, Europe's moribund. They're all old people with their vestigial anarchic pensions and welfare state. And, like, let them rot. Let them implode. Like, we're just going to go sell our stuff to the up-and-coming Indians and Chinese.
And how did people react to what was going on in Egypt? I mean, was there much reaction? Felix had written that very funny satire, essentially, yeah, saying that the people basically saying that, you know, good for everybody at Davos for bringing about this this blossoming revolution there.
It was totally bizarre. There was a total disconnect. And now, part of that is that programming happens way in advance. And part of it, you know, on the last day, there was a panel with a bunch of people, a former British diplomat from who'd been in the Middle East, someone who'd been very high in the Mexican government, Martin Wolf. I mean, so they tried to put this ad hoc panel together on Egypt. And, you know, because there was some sense that, like, we can't ignore this thing. But for the most part, it really was, like, taking place on another planet. And basically, there's this sort of, like, central schmoozing area where people sit and they have Wi-Fi and there's coffee and where I spent most of my time. And you just see, like, all of the Arab men who were there, and they were mostly men, you know, clustered around iPads watching Al Jazeera. I mean, I was sitting there, like, in this, like, corner where, like, I have Al Jazeera English streaming on my iPad, and the guys next to me all have Al Jazeera Arabic, and we're all just, like, sitting there with our headphones plugged in watching. you know, part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that, like, from the perspective of business, you know, it so much is about China and India, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, the Middle East, it's like a... You know, it just no one seems that interested, you know, aside from the fact there's, you know, oil there.
Right, and Egypt is not necessarily a terribly big oil-producing country.
Right, no, it's not. And one of the things I thought was really interesting, you know, that was brought up at the panel on Egypt is that, you know, and this has cracked me up. I'm sure you've seen on cable news, like, they'll do, you know, to their credit. I mean, I think, look, this is a hard thing to do for cable news is to say, hey, America, you know nothing about this.
Right.
Most likely know nothing about this place in which something really important is happening, so let us get you up to speed. And so, you know, CNN International, which I was watching a bit, would flash these things where it would say, you know, here's some stats on, you know, per capita income, whatever. And I love, they'll flash the unemployment rate in Egypt is 9.7%, and they say that's the official number, but it's probably much higher, as if, like, well, no wonder they're riding the streets. Well, guess who else has, like, a 9.7% unemployment rate,
right,
officially with a real one? That's much higher, you know? And someone else said, you know, someone else at Davos broke up that Egypt actually, you know, from the perspective of its, from the perspective of GDP statistics, has actually experienced fairly decent annualized growth. I think it grew at about 5.4%.
Over the past 20 years, it seems to have grown exponentially.
And that's where, you know, distribution really matters.
Right.
I have, if your listeners want to listen to some more of me talking, although mostly just asking questions, we just put up a podcast, The Breakdown, which is a podcast I do once a week with a professor of Egyptian history who talks about just the crazy concentration of wealth that that has happened in Egypt, particularly over the last decade. So, you know, distribution matters. You know, it's not enough to say that an economy is growing.
All right. Well, Chris Hayes, thanks for joining us. We will put a link up to The Breakdown at majority.fm. Thanks for joining us, and we will send you that picture, your Davos commemorative picture of you in a Sky Mall leather bombardier jacket. No tax.
I can't wait. I'll be forwarding it to my publisher, obviously.
Great. All right. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
All right, Jeff.
Bye-bye. That was Chris Hayes on his jaunt to Davos. So jet set. I am looking forward to an opportunity to maybe head to Hoboken over the next couple of weeks.
It's not worth it.
That's not worth it. No, it isn't. All right, folks. You can IM me at Majority FM on the other side of this program. Please, folks. I know there are literally thousands of you enjoying these interviews, my commentary, the banter, the amazing banter that I have with Evan and Dorsey. Please support the show. Become a member. $10 a month. Or you can go all the way up. Listen, however much you want to give above 10, I am all down with that. 10 is good too. You can become a member at majority.fm. And also, when you buy coffee or chocolate or tea from justcoffee.coop, You put in majority in there, you get a 10% discount, and we see a tiny piece of that. Stick around in the post show. Apparently, I'm now in a battle with Marc Maron, and some of you may want to hear about it right after this. We are back. All right. Let's see what we got here. I am me at Majority FM. Chris Hayes is so fantastic. I always like talking to him. All right. Let's read a couple. Well, you folks managed to piss off Marc Maron. Got a... Oh, fuck it. He's not going to come on the show. Not now. So might as well go full bore with this. So last night at quarter ten, I get a text. What are you doing, man? Question mark. Well, the bullshit on air. What do you want? And so who knows what anybody emailed him. Because I know he's not listening to the show. Mark, listen, I'm going to speak to you directly now. I know you're not listening to this. So I know you can't hear it. And I wrote back, what do you mean? I pimped your Gallagher episode. Oh, wait, you didn't listen to it. What, did Dane Cook the Man tweet you? He's mad. But, you know, that's how I'll get invited onto his show at one point. It'll be a great podcast. I'll be on like, we had a falling out. Yeah.
That's what friends are for.
So inappropriate of me, but what are you going to do, folks? I'm having a little fun. I mean, I had a very frustrating day yesterday. And so I'm trying to blow off some steam. What am I going to do? Hit my kid? I can't do that. She's too cute. This is what she said to me the other day. I had apparently told Nikki. Do you remember this, Dorsey? The day that you came in... The show is starting, and Dorsey comes like just screaming into the studio. Now, understand when I say studio, or when I say office, or when I talk about there's no difference, which is why there's been occasion where like just the UPS guy, we can't figure out what to do with this, because if we lock the door, the UPS guy starts banging on the door. If we don't lock the door, the UPS guy just comes not even creeping in with the door open. He just busts open the door and just walks right in and just like hands me something to sign. I'm on air. And what are you going to do? This is the operation that we have. Folks, when I say that when we take your Majority Report membership money and we put it into the show, understand that we have no fat here. There's no... You know, maybe we should get rid of the whole, Friday buffet that we have catered or something. You know, we don't do that. And so Dorsey comes running into here, 11:35 or something, 11:32. He's got to set up the video camera. And immediately, I don't know what day it was, but you can hear that I'm like, all of a sudden, like my throat is seizing up. I can't breathe. I'm trying to Dorsey. And I'm like, what are you doing? What's going on? And I'm like, what's that smell? And he says, well, I didn't have a chance to go home last night. This gives you a sense of what Dorsey's life is like. I didn't have a chance to go home last night. I was working until I've run in here and I have a chance to shower. And so I got a date. So I put on a bunch of cologne. On his jacket. What did you do? Stick it in like.
I was also out with my friends or at their studio, and they all smoke. So I
so what'd you do? Just like pour it onto your jacket?
No, I went two extra squirts. You know, it's like, one from me.
And so, Dorsey takes the coat, he puts it outside, and I can, you know, within moments after the window's open, I can breathe and everything's okay. I'm not having a seizure. And so I'm telling Nikki the story because every time Nikki puts on perfume, I'm like, please, sweetie, you smell great without perfume. Please don't do that. So I tell her the story to sort of reinforce it so that she doesn't think it's some type of like passive aggressive hostility that I have towards her. Because I have to justify it with other examples, which, you know, if you are married, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Your wife doesn't believe me about anything I say unless I bring in a third party or some other anecdote that establishes that what I'm saying is legitimate. No matter what it is, I always have to, like, I say something, she's like, that's crazy, what are you talking about? And then I'll have to, like, all right, hold on, let me call Jim and have Jim tell you that what I'm saying is not crazy. So I told her the story, and must have been at the dinner table, and Myla's there. And so ever since then, you know, I told this story that Dorsey had a date. So ever since that time, Myla has been strangely obsessed with Dorsey's, like, dating status. And she, like, out of nowhere, if I'm talking about work in any way, Nikki, how was work today? Oh, good. We got the Sinclair came, or that was the last conversation we had, which was, I guess, was the Sinclair came. That was probably 2 months ago. Myla will immediately ask me this question. And I said, you know what? I don't know the answer to it. Why don't we record it and I'll ask him? So here's the question. And I'll play it for you. Hold on. Let me put the... I got it. I recorded it on my phone. Here it is. Oh, I'm trying to. Oh, hold on. I got it. Okay. Hold on. Here it is.
Darcy, do you have a girlfriend?
Let me play it.
Darcy, do you have a girlfriend?
Now, why are you asking him that?
Because I just want to know why.
Why he has a girlfriend?
Yeah.
Darcy, why do you have a girlfriend?
I don't have a girlfriend.
I will tell Myla that. She'll be very interested to hear that you don't have a girlfriend.
I'll try to think of what my response is going to be to her next question.
Who knows? I will record it, though, I promise. All right, let's go to the IMs, folks. Anderson Cooper and his crew reportedly mobbed in Cairo earlier. He's on live now, so he must be okay. Harold, I think the feed went dead. You know, there was a problem with the feed today. I'm not sure. You on Marin show. Oh, you know, getting back to the Marin thing. Hold on, I had one more thing I wanted to read. I got a couple of emails about Marin. You know, this is not, Mark, I know you're not listening, but this is not me talking. This is from Colin. Hi. I, too, saw Marin in Portland last week. After the show, I asked him if he would be on your show. Some of his comments were, what would we talk about? I still love him. And I'll come on eventually. I love Mark, too. I think that's the thing, is we sort of have like a brother relationship, like an estranged brother relationship. I don't even think we're estranged until he gets wind of this. And then Marilyn writes me, Dear Sam, if you have Mark Maron as a guest, I won't listen. It wouldn't even be funny. So I don't know. I don't know what to say. Right in the middle of you reading tweets from Egypt, the feed went dead. All better, probably just a browser delay. You on Marin show, better bring a sledgehammer and a watermelon, he says. Day-day fru, heading out to Tampa Bay today, going to the beach. Wanted to say thanks for the Billy Bragg at the pre-show. Be warm and safe. Tampa Bay, home of the RNC convention in 2012. It was just announced that the DNC is going to be held in North Carolina, and which is probably the least unionized state in the country. And that's an issue. It's also indicative of the Democratic Party's not standing with unions in the way they should. I mean, The local unions wanted the DNC to come, obviously, because it's going to increase jobs. But there's much more unionized states, and you got to show support for the unions. Of course, I will go. Classic dilemma. Nefertiti, Sammy, audio is breaking up every 4 seconds. Oh, my God, Mila's sounding so grown up. Matthew asks, you're going to cover the health care decision in the Senate Judiciary hearing. Didn't I cover the health care decision the other day? I haven't heard the hearing. When is the hearing? Didn't I cover the health care decision yesterday? I talked about Vincent. Do you listen to the show?
Occasionally.
Yeah, Dorsey?
Yeah, you talked about it yesterday.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to break
I guess that answers the question
for
Dorsey.
Trying to break news here, man. Good
God. I did cover the Vincent decision yesterday. I have not heard the Senate Judiciary hearing. I will check on that. I mean, yes, Matthew, you must have been working. Now, there are two Matthews who I am me. And I was talking to the other Matthew, and he was saying, thanks for mentioning me. I said, I don't know if I mentioned you. I think I mentioned the other Matthew. But Matthew G, Matthew W. I did mention it yesterday, Matthew. Frisbin, those chemicals you listed are active ingredients in strong paint solvent products. They are very nasty. Yes, I'm sure that they're very nasty to paint, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you wouldn't want to drink them in your water. I mean, if it's going towards bringing us natural gas, why wouldn't you be willing to sacrifice just a little bit of a certain taste in your water? After a while, you can get used to that taste. Majority follower, my wife is in water testing. And after 9/11, they went through a lot of security measures to ensure that terrorists didn't contaminate the water. Now we learned at the same time, Cheney allowed Halliburton to contaminate our water. We can only protect America as long as it doesn't affect a corporation's bottom line. It would just be nice for mainstream media to point out this hierarchy. You're absolutely right. And, you know, this AP story was just really poorly written. How do you not make explicit the fact that the reason why there's some contention between these industries and the notion of an apparent violation of the Safe Water Drinking Act is because legislatively a loophole has been built to basically say they can do whatever they want. It's just incredible irresponsibility by this reporter. It's almost impossible to believe that they were not aware of this. And if they weren't aware of this, they have no business reporting on it. A 5-minute Google search could tell you this. It's infuriating. That story does less to educate the public than no story at all. Gatteron, right-wing guest on Chris Matthews' show last night, got tongue-tied and called Richard Lugar dick licker.
God, I wish I was watching Matthews last night.
I think it was Lee Fernley. Kevin Semicolon, I had to step out during the Chris Hayes segment. Did he get to drink scotch with Charlie Rose? I did not ask him that, but I will send him that question. You got to listen to that segment. It was great. Chris Hayes is just so fantastic to talk to about just about anything. I should have asked him about Charlie Rose. Listen to that Gallagher episode. You know Marin better than I, but he was no more manic than usual, halfway listenable even. No, I thought it was incredibly entertaining. And I thought Marin was great on it. G's excuses were so indefensibly pat, I would guess his compartmentalized notion of humor are rarely challenged, within or without. Yeah, he lives in a different world. But, you know, when you got a guy who you're talking about whether or not he's racist or homophobic because of what he says, you almost want to get inside him first and ask the question coming out of him, if that makes sense. Get his internal logic as to why these tell these jokes and what he perceives them to be. And then come in with, but you realize these jokes are perceived as racist, and this is why, or homophobic. But nevertheless, I found it incredibly entertaining, and probably more entertaining than any interview I would ever do with Gallagher. Just what we need, more stuff for Bonaire to cry about. When I was a child, I had an affair. Nothing against Marin, but he was the weaker link on Break Room Live. I haven't heard his new podcast, so I don't know why it's so appealing, but I was never a fan of the whiny, neurotic rants. Might be good for comedy, but it doesn't work as well for political commentary. You know, I would disagree with the assessment that he was the weaker link. I mean, I think maybe, you know, we never reached a broader audience, which was on the agenda because of the way that Air America made us do things, frankly. And I think the mix could have been really, really good. But I think Marin felt uncomfortable in that format and in that sort of universe. And he's far more comfortable in the one he's doing now. And it's wildly successful. I mean, it's wildly successful and it's very entertaining. It's virtually the only podcast I listen to. And I, you know, I don't listen to it on a regular basis, but I've listened to a bunch. But, you know, comedy's not for everybody. Sammy Camera One, independent analysis. Nikki smells better than Dorsey. Dradmanthes. Chris Hayes should have said that the Walmart executive himself is radical. They largely destroy private sector unions in this country and are working on reproducing that in other countries. Speaking of which, it's unbelievable that unions are now framed as radical by the center and the right. Unions are a capitalist solution to worker exploitation. They are a preventive measure against socialism and communism. And now all of a sudden they are just conflated with them. That's a very good point. I mean, that is... And, you know, I think the other point that one might make is that in their absence, the real question is, what is going to co-opt this type of rampant capitalism? There are some who argue, and I think not without merit, that things like the Affordable Care Act, where you provide just a basic minimum coverage for people, but at the same time still enrich these industries, is a mechanism to deflate a little bit air out of the tire, a co-opting measure so that people aren't dying in the streets and you know, calling for some type of revolution in this country. Now, it sort of seems ridiculous to say those words at this point because, you know, the sort of the disconnect that people have just from their economic situation to government policies, to long-term societal policies is stunning in this country. It's stunning. And their sense that there's just been a very successful cultural movement that basically has, you know, ingrained this notion that, you know, you get what you deserve. If you're not rich, it's because, you know, you don't deserve to be rich. If you don't have health care or child care, or it's because you haven't worked hard enough. And perhaps there was more of this in the, you know, the first half of the last century, because maybe there was just more immigrants. I mean, there was more immigrants. Let me rephrase this. There were immigrants who were coming from societies that had a tradition of more workers' rights and a tradition of rising up against the king, as it were. And as those generations have passed and more people have become acclimated to this mentality, and when you have immigrants now, Spanish-speaking immigrants, they haven't necessarily integrated into the culture and maybe don't have the same traditions of social unrest, perhaps, or actually are just so economically isolated that they don't have a sense of their own power in the system. And maybe that will change over time. I mean, when you see like those marches that took place 2 years ago during immigration reform, you have a sense that there is an amazing amount of raw political power there that has yet to be. I was just saying that the other day, too. My wife sometimes, to my wife, sometimes I miss the Soviet Union, not because I ever liked it itself, but because it was always there as an example of what we had to be better than. We just don't have that clear competitor anymore, and especially since, because it was a dominant empire, the U.S. doesn't pay attention to what developing countries following alternative. Further left paths are doing, such as South American examples of Brazil and Argentina, Bolivia and Paraguay. That's true. Somehow we don't get that, both as a model for what our society could be, and we don't get that influence from workers, from middle-class people basically saying, I've had enough. I mean, I think what you're seeing in Egypt is very much at least spearheaded and instigated by middle-class and the poor as in a very secular uprising in Egypt. And apparently, you know, like I think I said, we were talking about with Heather Hulbert, there would have been 1,600 labor strikes over the past 5 or 6 years. Bush in chains. Had to be a Mubarak thug raining blows on Anderson Cooper's head. Oh, well, a girl can dream. Reagan Solicitor General Charles Fried, I am quite sure that the health care mandate is constitutional. Well, yeah, that may be the case. I mean, the problem is that what is constitutional is a function of what the Supreme Court says, and we have seen that they are not bound by precedent, even their own, and are nakedly partisan. So if they find a way of, and by partisan, I'm not just talking about Republican. I mean, they're, you know, even the four that we nominally call left to center are corporatists. And but they are more neoliberal in their sense. Like, you know, let's make sure the masses don't revolt as long as the corporations are making their money. What Jersey Star are you? Find out your Jersey Shore nickname here. When addressing the Maren Gallagher shipwreck, you must focus like a laser beam on the so-called homophobic jokes. One was a butt sex thing using roids to cover the guys. The other was a cunnilingus reference to cover the girls. And Maren is the dude whose sponsor has some kind of lovely freaky toys. Just giving him a hard time. It was good radio. Maren would have hit a home run if he had been just eased off about 5 seconds before Gallagher stormed off. Well, Gallagher leaving was one of the best parts about it, too. Kat Fudan, what do you think about Homeland Security and ICE immigration being used to go after internet streaming? BitTorrent, this was a Sunshine Gym post at BRR. I've seen Homeland Security shutting down sites. I didn't know that ICE was involved in it. It's ridiculous. You know, where are the free marketers? Where are the libertarians screaming about the use of our tax dollars to protect the so-called intellectual property of multinational corporations? Why is that the job of our government? Well, partly mentioned in the Constitution, actually. But I missed half of the Chris Hayes interview. Did you see my Photoshop mashup with Friedman's ultra leather jacket on the recap yesterday by your request? He will. He will. Abaddon says, it really is infuriating to see such laziness on the part of reporters. Those of us who actually had to pound our articles on typewriters used to have to go to some effort to find out who the relevant experts to talk to on each of these subjects were. Make phone calls, go to offices, even go to the library to find articles from newspapers out of town. Their job has been made so easy by the internet, but instead of doing it, they decide it doesn't need to be done at all. It's true, Abaddon. Don't be a putz. Humanitarian of the Year Jim Cramer was on Morning Joe this morning saying the only important issue in Egypt is the Suez Canal and how it'll affect the corporate profits. You know, it is going to be interesting. And I meant to ask this to Chris Hayes, but this would have been a different topic. As he was talking about the difference between the crisis in the 70s and the sort of the rewriting of the paradigm at that time and the lack of it now, one has to wonder what will happen if this instability in Egypt spreads as it is, it potentially could. Now, the fact that I know there's going to be a protest in Syria on Saturday leads me to believe that the Syrian government is going to quash it. But as these notions of democracy, who was it? Was it in Kuwait or Yemen where the government basically just said, oh, hey, incidentally, coincidentally, we're going to give everybody a check for $4,000 or $3,400. You read about that? Every citizen was given a check.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I know Kuwait arrested a bunch of people for planning to protest in solidarity.
So there you have it. And you know, when oil prices right now, they're New York tends to be much more expensive gas prices, but they're creeping up fairly significantly. And, you know, we had, $4 gas prices before the financial crisis, right? What happens when we get $4 or $5 gas prices with the economy in the state that it is? You know, at one point we may hit a point where people start to say, ask some fundamental questions about the way our society is organized. I see no evidence of it. I see no evidence of it. I discount what I see here because these you people are the some of the most informed people out there. And then I go from here into the subway, up to my house, and then I do some more work, and I go to sleep, and then I come down here, and vice versa, and occasionally I stop by my agent's office and get a sense of what the genuine sort of obliviousness is on some level. I'm not being mean-spirited about this. I'm making a completely non-judgmental observation. Chris, I agree. Marin's podcast is cool for what it is. He does a great comedy interview. Majority Report is great for what it is, politics and humor. I enjoy both and still buy WTF blend with Majority Code. That's exactly how I would put it, Chris, until, of course, we come out with a Majority Report blend, in which case you're going to have a dilemma. That still worked. Zach Punk, not only are unions a capitalist solution to prevent socialism, so are healthcare mandates. I beat you to it, buddy. I mean, you may have said it before me, but I didn't see it. Do you have any more time to do videos? Your That's Bullshit series were great. Quick hits for on-the-fence conservative friends and family. We are working on that. I cannot tell you how complicated things can be sometimes around here. Sound issues, video issues, lighting issues, space issues.
Cologne issues.
Cologne issues. We're just trying to make it so I can breathe. But yes, can you guys put up bios and contact information for yourself and the crew? Dorsey in a band, Twitter links for others? I'd follow them. You know, that's a very good point. We should be doing that on the About page.
As soon as I get done breaking news.
What news are you breaking?
I was just trying to get the Stark thing out there.
Oh, okay, good.
I thought BuzzFeed would be a good place. They love affair stuff.
Rachel Maddow had reported last night that Mubarak's wife had raided their bank account and flown to Saudi Arabia. It sounds to me like he's on his way out, and the speech was just about biding time. No, it sounds to me like he's being cautious. He's being cautious. I think, you know, you don't send your thugs in to, what is he biding time for? Once the money's out, does he really need to send his internal police force, his internal paramilitary force to go in and crack heads in Liberation Square? I mean, do you want to be the guy that the next government may try and extradite? I don't think so. I think if you really think it's over and you're willing to step down, then you say, for the good of Egypt, and you make yourself a martyr and a national hero. I have heard the people. And rejected the $25 million that was going to be sent to me from some oil company or foreign government who wanted me to make sure that I stayed in power so that I could get Suleiman to be the guy who follows me. I've rejected that money. So please, donate to me at my PayPal link. I mean, this is speculation on my part, but that's got to be how it works, right? I mean, if a government, the U.S. government, the Chinese government, the Russian government, I don't know, the British government, Saudi Arabia, if they all think it's in their interest that the next leader of Egypt is Suleiman, as opposed to, say, El-Baradei, or someone from the Muslim Brotherhood, or someone they don't know. And we're spending $1 billion a year on Egypt, presumably for to buy some semblance of stability. How much money would somebody simply say pay to Mubarak and say, dude, here, I'm going to give you an incentive to hang in there. Yeah, your name's going to be mud, but listen, we have a sweet villa for you in any number one of any one of the number countries where you can hang out. You just got to get us somebody in there who is going to basically do what you've been doing. I mean, if you think of the self-interest that different countries and corporations have, and think about how much money they're willing to spend on, you know, just how many millions of dollars did BP spend on, new ads just because of the Gulf spill? How much money would they offer Mubarak to just try and get another strongman in there? Don't worry. We've got your wife. She's in Saudi Arabia. She's got your cash. There's going to be another suitcase waiting for you there if your mission is successful. I mean, honestly, I mean, it would almost be, if you accept their logic, it would almost be irresponsible for them not to do something like that. I mean, nobody thinks really that somebody's like, how about you make the best of a bad situation and do a man on the street interview with the FedEx guy one day, and do a man on the street interview with the FedEx guy one day if he shows. Yes, actually, we have done that, haven't we? Didn't I ask one guy early on?
Yeah.
What did I ask him? What do you think of the healthcare bill? I think it was. Yeah, definitely we'll do that. Hugh BC, there is a fundamental contradiction. The religious right doesn't believe in evolution, but they are committed to the dogma of social Darwinism. Well, that's not a fundamental. I don't think that's a fundamental contradiction. Social Darwinism is different than evolution. Sugar High, I think there's a strong case of the government enforcing copyright law, but the FBI should be doing it, not Homeland fucking security. Placing Just Coffee order now, 4 12 ounces. Sweet. Ooh. Let's see. BRR. Oh, Blue Roots Radio. Sam Cedar Show spin-up blog. Sorry. Little girls dating issues. I don't know what that means. Taurasi. Back when he was a member of the House, Senator Mark Kirk was one of a few Republicans who voted for the climate change bill. Now, quote, the consensus behind climate change has collapsed. The bill collapsed and further deteriorated with the personal political collapse of Vice Presidential Al Gore. What? That's insane. Majority follower. I went to see Mark Maron when he was in Atlanta. He went off on my wife. He went off with your wife or on your wife? Now I'm only allowed to listen to his podcast at work. Ah, she allows me to listen to you. And in fact, I have to turn it up since she loved you ever since you spit out your sake on Sex and the City. You are known as the cute spitting guy at home. That's exactly how I'm known at my house, too. Real Americans only rise up to protest American Idol injustices. Yes. Bush and Chains breaking. Egyptian museum reportedly on fire.
No. I just saw that they're burning cars around the museum, and it looks like it's on fire.
Wow. Bush and Chains, I can see Egypt from my porch, front porch, says Sarah Palin. I liked Maron. You could tell that any funny criticism had of him would genuinely make him mad. Oh, definitely. Good cure for cologne sensitivity is to drink some benzene-laced water. Don't be a putz. Noam Chomsky was interviewed by Amy Goodman for over an hour this morning. He mentioned that U.S. always chooses to back Islamist regimes because it's a safeguard against the secular nationalism, their ultimate fear. Interesting. I don't know that the Muslim Brotherhood is sort of meets that standard. And I wonder if that's, I don't know that they're looking for Islamist regimes as much as they are ones that are sort of like, maybe he's talking like Saudi Arabia is, but I don't know how, I don't know what that means, Islamist in this, but I guess more religiously founded, because that sort of eliminates sort of, I guess that eliminates the sort of like any type of other secular religion that could develop, i.e. One based on sort of a different economic structure. Guy from Silent Hill, also, can you put up bios? And I did that. Don't think it was Mubarak's wife. I think it was the wife of Tunisia's leader. Cool J, 146. Even though I have mixed feelings about the healthcare reform, I am thankful that I can stay on my parents' plan until I'm 26. I previously had to buy privately, and I believe for around $600 a month. Some of the Tea Party people are definitely affected by this. I wonder if it will have any effect on their collective opinion. Though obviously it's a very top-down movement. Well, yes, I actually think it will, and I actually think that is the dilemma that Republicans have, is that they know there are people actually getting benefits now and are already starting to become sort of attached to this. All right, folks, that's the show for today. Please join us tomorrow. Will Bunch will be here. We will give you further updates. Make sure you check out Ring of Fire this weekend. I'll be talking to Juan Cole tomorrow afternoon. Couldn't get him on this program this week, but he will be on Ring of Fire. And become a member, blah, blah, blah. You know how that goes. All right, folks. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.